Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 8th of February. First hour of our program today, we go back in history. 62 years ago tomorrow, February 9, 1950, Senator Joseph McCarthy started his anti-communism crusade during a speech in Wheeling, West Virginia, the Enemies from Within speech, in which he said that there were 205 communists within the State Department. His crusade continued for about 4 years, and most of us know the history of that. Maybe not as well known, and our guest this hour has written about young Bob La Follette, who was the son of Wisconsin's legendary progressive governor and senator fighting Bob La Follette. It's frequently been mentioned that it's interesting that a state produced both Joseph McCarthy and fighting Bob La Follette. But our guest writes in a piece that Joseph McCarthy's detractors used to enjoy noting the irony that one of the worst senators in American history had replaced one of the best. In a year of political upsets, McCarthy's defeat of young Bob La Follette in the 1946 Wisconsin Republican primary had been the biggest surprise of them all. La Follette was heir to the Wisconsin famous political dynasty and one of the most distinguished senators of his or any other time. If young Bob could be beaten, reporters said, anyone could be beaten. Before Wheeling, Joe McCarthy was known as a man who had defeated young Bob La Follette. The ironies run deeper, and the ironies are the relationship between progressivism and McCarthyism, which Patrick Maney writes about in an article, and we will discuss this hour of our program. Patrick Maney is a professor at Boston College, professor of United States history, 1865 to the present, the presidency and Congress. He has an emphasis on politics and the presidency. He has written biographies of Franklin D. Roosevelt and the New Deal Senator Robert La Follette Jr., one of the most prominent senators of the 30s and 40s. Until McCarthy defeated him. He's currently researching a book on the presidency of Bill Clinton, and he happens to be a native of Wisconsin, our guest. So we'll be welcoming phone calls, as we always do. I'm sure we'll have a few on this interesting topic. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Patrick Maney, thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning.
A Wisconsin guy you are, huh?
I am, and I'm glad to be home, if only on the radio.
It's always good to be home. It is. So much has been said over the years I've lived in this state about the fact that this state produced two wildly different people, Joseph McCarthy, and I think they refer to fighting Bob La Follette. How could you have a state that would do that?
Well, it's always been a curiosity about Wisconsin. I'm not sure that there is that much difference often between La Follette's and some of the insurgents, that even McCarthy, there was a sense that they were both outsiders fighting the northeastern part of the country. And so there are some similarities between McCarthy's followers and La Follette followers, but certainly no similarity in terms of their contributions to American political life.
Mm-hmm.
And the La Follette's really, including young Bob, and maybe even more so young Bob, left a permanent legacy that still exists today.
You start this article talking about one of the worst senators in American history replacing one of the best, that Joe McCarthy's detractors used to say that. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. Young Bob La Follette would make, I think, anybody's list of the top 10 senators in the 20th century. Social Security, first major unemployment relief during the Depression. He headed a major committee, Senate investigation of violations of labor's right to organize. He was just a model senator. And we remember McCarthy for the damage he did.
Mm-hmm. But probably not as well known, and you write about this, La Follette earned his anti-communist stripes before he entered the Senate. We don't think very much about La Follette and anti-communist stripes.
Well, in fact, in 1946, when McCarthy defeated La Follette made much more of an issue of communism and the dangers posed by Soviet expansionism than McCarthy. But in 1946, it was still not a benefit to do that. It was a liability. But La Follette was doing it in a responsible way.
He worked to keep, when you look at his father's candidacy, he worked to keep communists out because he thought it would be a liability for his father?
When his father ran for president on a third-party progressive ticket in 1924, young Bob was helping to manage the campaign, and he persuaded his father, who was reluctant about it, to refuse the endorsement of the American Communist Party. And so in 1924, at a very early age, La Follette, young Bob, probably did more to combat communism than Joe McCarthy did in his lifetime.
Mm-hmm. You also write that for those of us who grew up during the Cold War, it's hard to believe that criticizing the Soviet Union could have been politically risky. But it was politically risky for La Follette in 1945?
In 1945 and 46, because at that time the Soviet Union and the United States were still allied and in the battle against Germany, and so it wasn't. Well, and the Cold War didn't really settle in until 1946 and 47. So La Follette got a lot of criticism from both the right and the left when he started criticizing the Soviet Union.
Was the communist issue a big issue in the race between McCarthy and La Follette in 46, Patrick?
Only insofar as La Follette made it an issue. And he was warning that something needed to be done, more needed to be done to combat Soviet expansionism, but that the United States needed to be, in a sort of constructive way, alert to the dangers posed by communist infiltration of American institutions. McCarthy, for his part, made a little reference to communism, but not much at all. He hadn't discovered the issue yet.
When did he discover the issue, and why did he decide to run with it?
Well, he discovered it almost by accident. I mean, almost everybody in public life by the late 1940s, early 50s, had to be talking about the Soviet Union and communism. But it was in preparing for that speech that he gave in Wheeling, West Virginia, in 1950, that McCarthy had two speeches, actually. One was a speech on federal housing, and the other was on the menace of communism. And right at the last minute, when he got to Wheeling, West Virginia, and he was a backbencher at that time. Nobody had very little national reputation. But when he got to Wheeling, he was picked up at the airport, and he was talking to his sponsors and told them that, you know, he had a talk on housing or communism, and they suggested he go with communism.
Really? So he whipped out the communism speech.
So history might have been quite a bit different had he talked about the problems of federal housing.
So if you were in the audience, and I'm not sure who all was in the audience, and you heard him say today we're engaged in a final all-out battle between communistic atheism and Christianity, the modern champions of communists have selected this as the time, and ladies and gentlemen, the chips are down. They are truly down. Would you have been a little surprised to hear this kind of language, or would you have embraced it immediately?
Well, one thing about that speech, and we don't have a transcript of it, and it was not recorded, so we're not sure exactly what he said, but it was really a composite of what people had been saying for a number of years. He borrowed bits and pieces, including when he mentioned that he had a list of 205 persons communists in the State Department. That was something that had appeared in the congressional record 3 years before that. So this was kind of a put-up speech made up of various other speeches. So I don't think people would have been terribly surprised by the language of it.
So it was 200...
I think McCarthy himself was quite surprised at the attention the speech got.
Really? He said 205 at that speech 62 years ago tomorrow, but then right thereafter he wrote a letter to Truman, is this right, and said that it was 57 communists in the State Department?
The numbers were never quite clear.
Oh.
He started out with 205. Then it was a couple of days later, he was in Reno, and it was 81. Then when he got back to Washington, it was 57. So he was always juggling the numbers.
And in this letter, he talks about, I know absolutely of one group of approximately 300 certified communists to the secretary that were discharged because of communism. So he was just putting around all kinds of different numbers.
He was floundering, and yes, he was. And it is still, when you think of it, nothing against Wheeling, West Virginia, but if you did have this dramatic disclosure about 205 communists in the State Department known to the Secretary of State, that's an odd place to have made that dramatic announcement.
What was the occasion of the speech? Why was he there?
He was on the circuit to give a Lincoln Day addresses around the country, and he was invited by a Women's Republican group in Wheeling, and then he was going to go from there to North Dakota and then to Reno and Las Vegas and give other speeches.
Hmm. I didn't know. Where did I get this copy of the speech then? Where is this speech being circulated if nobody had a copy of the speech?
Well, there was a copy. We just don't know exactly whether he improvised or we do. There is a text that was written for him. And whether he stuck to the text, we're not sure. Mm-hmm. There are varying accounts of that. But that's probably pretty accurate. And he gave in subsequent speeches, he gave pretty much variations on that original speech that we do have the text for.
Do you know, was he advised that this was going to be his issue and it would ensure him, I don't know if he was even thinking about re-election in 52, but was somebody telling him you're on to something here, or did he fervently believe in the horrors of communism and just was single-minded about his devotion to getting rid of communists everywhere?
Well, I think both, in a way. I think he was looking for an issue that would help him get reelected, because he hadn't done much to earn reelection, and this was a big national issue. But whether he really believed it, it's not quite clear. He more stumbled on it, and I think was startled by the response he got, the enthusiastic response he got, and then just kept running with it. So in time, probably did come to believe what he was saying, but I don't think that's probably how it started out. It started out more as a political gimmick.
Did he receive a lot of media attention for that Wheeling speech, and what was the congressional reaction to that speech?
He eventually did. At first, there wasn't a whole lot of reaction, but then by the time he was traveling out west, he got more and more attention. And back in Washington, his speech was his accusations were greeted with skepticism, and shortly after he got back to Washington, there was a Senate investigation of his charges, led by a very conservative Democratic senator from Maryland, Millard Tidings, and that investigation said that he had perpetrated a fraud and a hoax on the public. It found no validation for any of his charges.
Mm-hmm. Eisenhower, the president, was no big fan of his. Can you talk about one of McCarthy's first attacks, who was on a nominee for ambassador to the Soviet Union, Eisenhower's nominee?
Right. And, of course, this the Wheeling speech, Harry Truman was still president, mm-hmm. and then Eisenhower later. But Eisenhower McCarthy really did probably help Eisenhower get elected in 1952, because that was such a potent issue, anti-communism was. But once elected, McCarthy slowly started to turn his attention from the Democrats to the Republicans. And so he challenged Eisenhower's patriotism, but his zealousness in ridding the State Department of supposed security risks and communists.
When did Edward R. Murrow get on the case?
You know, not really until late in the day, 1954, and that's also the same year as the Army-McCarthy hearings that that led to McCarthy's downfall. But early in 1954, Murrow devoted an entire program to McCarthy, mainly based on film clips of McCarthy himself. And then that was followed shortly after by the Army-McCarthy hearings, just about a month's worth of daily appearances by McCarthy, and that's really what undid him more, I think, than the legendary Edward R. Murrow program.
And let's go back to La Follette for a moment. How did La Follette respond to McCarthy's election, and how did he respond? I can't remember how long he lived, but how did he respond to the subsequent anti-communist campaign?
Well, initially, after he was defeated by McCarthy in the primary, he voted for McCarthy in the general election, and not because he had any personal liking for him, but because he did believe that it was important to elect Republicans who were more likely to be critical of the Soviet Union. But then by the 50s, he was really very critical of McCarthy, and in 1953, La Follette, who had gone into private life as a consultant for various businesses, in 1953 he became deeply apprehensive that McCarthy was going to summon him before his McCarthy's committee to testify about what La Follette knew about communist infiltration of American society and what La Follette had done about it. And in February 1953, La Follette committed suicide. And that wasn't the sole reason, his fear of McCarthy, but it was certainly a contributing factor.
Mm-hmm. Do you think McCarthy would have called him? Did he have...
You know, in researching the subject, I have looked for evidence of it, and I haven't found it. There may have been some contact. There's no proof of that, to be sure. But that certainly was on La Follette's mind. And I might add that... a lot of people don't know this, but La Follette was the sort of model for the main character in the Alan Drury classic about Washington, Advise and Consent. The main character commits suicide.
Hmm. We welcome phone calls. We'll take them in a moment. It was 62 years ago tomorrow that Senator Joseph McCarthy launched his anti-communism crusade, a speech in Wheeling, West Virginia, in which he said there were 255 known communists working within the State Department. The campaign, McCarthyism, continued for some 4 years, and we thought that we would talk about it partially because it was an important event in American history, and McCarthy was, of course, from the state of Wisconsin. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Our guest this hour is a professor of history at Boston College, Professor Patrick Maney. He is from Wisconsin originally. He teaches U.S. history, and he has written several books, a biography of Franklin D. Roosevelt and also a biography of New Deal Senator Robert La Follette, Jr. He is currently working on a book on the presidency of Bill Clinton. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, we will be talking with two of the actors who are in the current wonderful production of To Kill a Mockingbird. The Milwaukee Rep is doing this show, and they've already had to extend the performances because it is so wildly popular and beautifully done. It's also a part of the Big Read program, so there are teachers in residence. There are a lot of people reading To Kill a Mockingbird and a lot of discussions on the importance of that work. Lee Ernst, who plays Atticus Finch, will be with us, and Jonathan Daly, who plays Sheriff Heck Tate. So those are our guests, hour two of our program. Two phone calls now. We talk about Joseph McCarthy this hour. Eugene and Viola, hi.
Good morning, Kathleen. I grew up just south, outside of Sauk City, about 8 or 9 miles out of Sauk City, right after World War II. And I don't remember the years, but I think it was the early 50s. The owner of this newspaper in Sauk City started a drive to recall Senator McCarthy, and the drive failed, and the owner of the paper sold the paper afterwards.
Yes. Tell us about that recall attempt. Professor?
There was a Joe Must Go campaign to oust him from the Senate, and it did have some, it did get some traction, but certainly not enough to, you know how hard it is to recall an elected official. But it did, it had some national support and some considerable support in Wisconsin. And just on that subject, it's maybe worth noting that McCarthy was probably less popular in Wisconsin than he was around the rest of the country.
Why was that?
Well, people knew him. I mean, he and in 1952, when he did win re-election, he trailed all the rest of the ticket. I think he was 800,000 votes short of, or 80,000 votes short of Eisenhower.
Really?
Winning record. So I don't know. He's they knew him in some ways for what he was, and he had this more of kind of sinister aura around the country. But people maybe knew him too well to take him more seriously than they did. Mm.
Was there a primary challenge in 52?
There was, and it didn't go anywhere. But again, there was considerable support. And I guess it should also be pointed out, too, that McCarthy was a very skilled campaigner. When he beat La Follette in 1946, it wasn't that he was there. I mean, he did exaggerate his own war record, and he did smear some of La Follette's record. But mostly he won because he was he ingratiated himself with the public, and La Follette only campaigned for a week or 10 days or so, and people liked him. Even his enemies liked him. There was a famous publisher, editor of the longtime editor of the Progressive magazine, Morris Rubin, who was one of McCarthy's fiercest and most effective opponents. And Rubin would go to Washington, and he'd play poker with McCarthy. And he said, you know, he considered him a dangerous demagogue, but on a personal level, he liked him.
Hmm. So if you like poker and you like to drink, you liked him, or there was something more to liking him?
He was just he was down to earth and unpretentious in personal life, and so people, he did, you know, it wasn't people weren't in Wisconsin swept away by fear when they elected him. It was also the positive qualities that he had as a campaigner, and La Follette's weakness as a campaigner. Mm-hmm. By 1946.
How close was McCarthy to the Kennedy family?
Pretty close. Joe Kennedy, the patriarch of the Kennedys, was a financial supporter and a very close friend of Joe McCarthy. McCarthy was a frequent visitor to Hyannisport. He knew the Kennedy family intimately. Bobby Kennedy served on his committee. John Kennedy never once criticized Joe McCarthy. And when, in 1957, when McCarthy was censured by the Senate, Kennedy was in the hospital during that time, but at no time did he ever indicate that he would have supported censure.
What was it? An Irish connection, or
partly?
Really?
John Kennedy once told the historian Arthur Schlesinger that half of his constituents loved Joe McCarthy, so it would have been politically suicidal for Kennedy to have criticized him. But there was that close connection, and that was one thing that made the road to the Democratic nomination in 1960 a little more difficult for Kennedy, because liberals in the Democratic Party, led by Eleanor Roosevelt, were very skeptical of Kennedy because of his connection to McCarthy.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Eugene, for the call. We have a line open if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655 is the number. Bill in Neillsville. Hi.
Well, good morning. Yeah, I'm one of those people that likes Joe McCarthy. I don't know that much about him, but what a character. I wish we had more Joe McCarthys in Washington today. Maybe kind of straighten things out. But I find it kind of interesting that, you know, you seem to put a kind of a spin on this. one of the things that you said was that there was never any prosecutions. I thought that this Elder Hess or Hiss was prosecuted. And another thing was, it's my understanding that there was an evolution of the progressive movement, and the progressive movement really became the Communist Party, and the Democratic Party is what is now, or the Democrat Party is what now is what the Progressive Party was. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, in terms of Alger Hiss, that was really began before Joe McCarthy's Wheeling speech. And there's no question, I don't think, today that Alger Hiss had been a communist and had been involved in espionage. So McCarthy wasn't simply banging at the moon. There was a serious threat. But La Follette was addressing it in a more responsible way than McCarthy. And so the irony with McCarthy is, for all the things that he did, he didn't uncover a single communist. He wasn't responsible for the capture or discovery of a single communist. But then in terms of the progressive legacy of the Progressive Party or its affiliation, the Progressive Party was very much, by definition, the Wisconsin Progressive Party was anti-communist. Now, you might be confusing the Wisconsin Progressive Party with Henry Wallace's third party in 1948, and that did have some communist support, but there was no direct connection between Henry Wallace's third party and the Wisconsin Progressive Party.
And we would be remiss if we didn't mention the fact that so many people were blacklisted, people's careers were shattered, there were death threats on the children of people like Edward R. Murrow. It was a horrendous time.
It was a horrendous time. But it's important to realize, too, that there was McCarthyism before McCarthy, and there was McCarthyism after he died. So he was maybe got the most attention. But this exaggerated and I think harmful fear of communist infiltration of American institutions, that had been going on a long time before.
And what was the McCarthyism after he died?
Well, I think you see it during the 1960s, especially, and even later during the 1960s during the Vietnam War, people who challenged the war were their patriotism was often questioned, and I think just during the 1950s, the spectrum of in American history sort of narrowed. It was no longer possible to say after the 50s, after the McCarthyism and the Cold War, some of the things that were kind of routinely said before McCarthyism. I think even today we have a narrower debate than we once did in American history, especially when it comes to foreign policy, but on other things as well. So it was. We still feel the effects of McCarthyism.
Thanks for the call. Bill in Madison, hi.
Hi. Pat has no way of knowing this, but there was a strong anti-McCarthy movement early in the 50s out of his native Portage County. But the most prominent two members of it were two state legislators, Art Peterson from the western part of the state and Perry Franke, who a prominent Milwaukeean who just died this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, I mean, it is true, and a lot of the opposition to McCarthy in Wisconsin came not from the Democratic Party, but actually within the Republican Party. So there were, another person who, as a University of Wisconsin student, was active in anti-McCarthy activities was Lawrence Eagleburger, who later became Secretary of State.
Another Portage County emigre. Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks so much for your call.
You bet.
Hugh in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. McCarthy made communism an issue, more so. It had been an issue before. You had the Truman Attorney General, who gave a list of organizations where you would be fired. The FBI would ask people, this is before McCarthy, if you had black friends, or if you were black, if you had white friends, and that would be one indication that you might be a communist. And it was a long list of usually, I think Ku Klux was on it, but almost all of them were left-wing organizations, including the Civil Rights Congress, the Southern Negro Youth Congress, the International Labor Defense, and so forth. Many civil rights organizations were listed by Harry Truman, the Attorney General, and people were fired and blacklisted in the years before McCarthy becomes prominent on the issue. And this was by the Democrats. I think what McCarthy does, however, is make one aware of the possibility of spies. And I'm going to read just a sentence or so from Blacklisted by History by M. Stanton Evans. It shows, for instance, that the FBI knew as early as 1942 that J. Robert Oppenheimer, the director of the Atomic Bomb Project, had been identified by communist leaders as a party member, that high-level U.S. officials were warned that Alger Hiss was a Soviet spy almost a decade before his case became a public scandal, that a cabal of White House, Justice Department, and State Department officials lied about and covered up the Amerasia spy case and so forth. He made it an issue, it wasn't until the 1990s, for example, that we knew of the Atomic Spy Hall.
All right. Professor Meany.
Yeah, well, there's no question that there were, espionage agents and spies in the United States. McCarthy's activities didn't expose any of them. The Truman administration, FBI, had uncovered a number of espionage activities. And then, I think the caller's also correct. There were, even the Truman administration was targeting people that were just on the left and who were not involved in espionage. So I say there was a form of McCarthyism before McCarthy. One of the pioneers was Richard Nixon, who, running for the House of Representatives in 1946, the same year that McCarthy ran and was elected, had discovered really the communist issue before McCarthy and used it against Jerry Voorhees, who was a highly respected California congressman. So this existed before, and it would last a long time afterwards.
What did Nixon think of McCarthy?
It's hard to say. Nixon was very much admiring of young Bob La Follette, and when Nixon got to Washington, one of the first persons he looked up was young Bob La Follette after that election. I don't think that Nixon and McCarthy were ever very close personally, and then once Nixon became vice president, I think he one of his tasks given to him by Eisenhower was kind of to try to keep McCarthy in check, a task which was proved impossible.
Thanks, Hugh, for the call. Mark in Edgerton. Hello, Mark.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I heard earlier your comments, Professor, about Morris Rubin being friendly with McCarthy. I knew somebody in Wisconsin Rapids when I was a reporter there in the 80s and the 90s. Philio Nash, the former political leader in the Democratic Party, and Edith Nash, his wife. And Philio was attacked on the floor of the Senate by McCarthy in a vicious, really unprincipled sort of way, because his sister Jean Nash, who owned a cranberry marsh in Wisconsin Rapids, took out an ad against McCarthy when he came to speak at the local Chamber of Commerce. The idea that McCarthy might have some principled reasons for fighting communism really was destroyed for me when I heard about that incident.
And one thing about McCarthy, I don't think he... I don't think he realized the damage that he did to individuals. There are stories about him denouncing somebody who was appearing before his committee and then going up and putting his arm around the person, asking if there is anything he could do for him. So I don't think he understood that how much he was hurting people. And, of course, the people I think that were hurt most were not the Secretary of State or Secretary of the Army, but like the civics teacher in the small town or the librarian who if they had any unorthodox views would get in have to be quiet or get in trouble. So that's where the real damage was, I think.
Well, he must have had absolutely no secondary awareness. How can you not know?
I don't know. I mean, there are these stories, like with when he would be with Morris Rubin, who, again, as I say, there was nobody more effective in fighting McCarthy. But when they were together, it was as though McCarthy didn't sort of hold it, didn't take it personally. And Rubin, you know, facing that, couldn't build up a huge personal dislike for McCarthy, even though he was doing everything within his power to bring him down.
Wow, that's sort of hard to understand, isn't it?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I was reading a couple of weeks ago about Newt Gingrich after having savaged John King during one of those debates. Went up and was talking cordially to him afterwards, and it was just like, you know, that's part of the game. And I think there was that element to McCarthy that he did come to believe this, but there was also that this was politics.
Here's an email that's come in from a listener. My dad graduated in 1955. He went through every year of high school listening to McCarthy's accusations. As a result, my parents are both conspiracy fanatics. Perhaps many from that era were affected the same way. Do we know the effect McCarthy had on the psyche of the citizens of this country?
Well, I think anybody growing up in the late 40s and 1950s, when communism was just the fear of communism was just being drummed into everybody. I mean, if you were in the Boy Scouts, you had to memorize the evils of communism, and parochial school students, as I was one, were taught about how godless communism was. So, yeah, this was it's hard to explain this now since the end of the Cold War. It's hard to explain how all-encompassing the Cold War was during the 1950s and 60s and how it shaped everything.
Yes. We go to Art in Wausau. I mean, Ed in Wausau. Hi, Ed.
Hi. I'd just like to mention, I lived in Madison. I was born in 42 and my dad was in the Philippines. Our next-door neighbor was, they were both, my next-door neighbor was in the Navy. My dad was in the Army Air Corps. But coincidentally, later on, when I was in the Army, I was down in Brooke Army, San Antonio, Texas, for training as a medic, and I had to go home on emergency leave, and our plane took off from San Antonio and landed in Dallas because Sam Rayburn had died, but we landed in Dallas. It wasn't scheduled, and Harry Truman got on the aircraft.
No!
And I was sitting in first class along with a stewardess that was deadheading it, and there was one other person. And the stewardess had been up at a party, and she slept the whole time. but I saw Truman get on, and he went out with two other individuals. I was assuming one of them was security, and he had the fasten the seatbelt sign on. And after that sign was off, I went over and introduced myself. I had my uniform on with my, you know, medical caduceus. And Truman said to me, he said, "You look like a tied-down dog." but he was in Dallas because Sam Rayburn died, who was Speaker of the House at that time. And but it was just an unbelievable reading. When I returned to Brooke Army, the first sergeant, you know, was questioning my delay, and I showed him the signature because Truman had signed my aircraft ticket. But it was just amazing. But Truman did say, I remember I was in Madison. I said, yeah, my dad drugged me up the Capitol steps to see you during the 48 election. But it was just a neat meeting, and I just wanted to mention that.
Thank you, Ed.
That sounds like it, yeah.
Yeah, thanks so much for your call. We go next to Art in Kenosha. Hi, Art.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask about President Eisenhower's role.
Okay.
With McCarthy and also La Follette. Fred Greenstein, one of the first and most visible of the Eisenhower revisionists, described Ike playing the role of the genial, disengaged, fatherly golfer, while meanwhile working extremely ruthlessly and very hard to bring down and destroy McCarthy.
Mm.
Quite behind the scenes. What's your view on that?
Did you hear that okay, Patrick?
I did.
Okay.
There's still some controversy about Eisenhower's role, of course, in during the 1952 campaign. Eisenhower initially was criticized by many because he came into McCarthy's home state, gave a speech in Green Bay, and at the last minute deleted from his speech a defense of George C. Marshall, who had been really one of the architects of American victory in the Second World War, but who was also had been accused by McCarthy of being a pawn of the Soviet Union. And Ike was going to defend his old boss, but then deleted it for political reasons. Part of the reason that that Eisenhower didn't attack McCarthy personally was he feared that he would just call more attention to McCarthy if the President of the United States makes an issue out of this and calls out McCarthy. McCarthy would become bigger than he was. And yet it's hard to imagine McCarthy becoming any bigger or more powerful or more public a figure than he became. So I'm not sure that Eisenhower's strategy worked. But there is no question but that not by 1954, after McCarthy went after Eisenhower's beloved army, that Eisenhower was acting very aggressively behind the scenes, in part through Nixon, too, to bring about McCarthy's demise. Mm.
Great question. Thanks, Art, very much for your call. We'll take a few more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about Joseph McCarthy. It was 62 years ago tomorrow, actually, February 9th, 1950, that he gave his Enemies Within speech in Wheeling, West Virginia, in which he claimed, on that day at least, there were 205 communists in the State Department. And then he wrote a letter to Truman shortly thereafter saying, well, the number was different, so he kept using these different numbers, and you know the story and what ensued, the era of McCarthyism in this country. We thought that we would pay attention to that date in history, partially because he is from Wisconsin. And our guest is Professor Patrick Maney. He is a professor of history at Boston College and has written a book, actually, about he's written a book about Robert La Follette Jr., and one of the chapters that we talked about earlier dealt with the relationship between La Follette and McCarthy, which is fascinating. He has written biographies of Roosevelt and the New Deal Senator Robert La Follette Jr., one of the most prominent U.S. senators of the 30s and 40s until his defeat by McCarthy. All right, more phone calls in a moment. I'll give you the number once again, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Following the news from NPR at 10 o'clock here on the Ideas Network, two of the actors who are in the Milwaukee Reps current production of To Kill a Mockingbird. Lee Ernst, who plays Atticus Finch, and Jonathan Daly, who plays Sheriff Heck Tate, will be with us to talk about this beautiful work of art, and it's a lovely, lovely, stirring performance. So they will be with us the second hour. Ruth in Waukesha, hi.
Are you talking to Ruth?
Yes, I hope so. Are you Ruth?
Yes.
Hi, Ruth.
Hi. My husband graduated from Marquette and received a job on the Milwaukee Sentinel. It was the McCarthy era. His as a copy reader to do the headlines, And we were not pro-McCarthy, and so he kind of was middle of the road, and they insisted that he make the headlines really pro-McCarthy.
Really?
And that was a conflict of his conscience, and but he tried to stay middle of the road, and they fired him. The Milwaukee Sentinel fired him. So that really was a big turning point in our life.
Is he still alive, your husband, Ruth?
No.
Can you say his name?
John Brown.
John Brown.
Yeah, with an E at the end.
Do you still have copies of the headlines?
I don't think so.
Hmm.
That would be really kind of interesting to have.
To see those again, yes. Professor Maney.
Well, within Wisconsin, the Milwaukee Journal and especially the Capital Times of Madison were very critical of McCarthy. But he did have some fervent support within the state, and the Milwaukee Sentinel was one place where it appeared. Although by 1954, the Sentinel was very critical of McCarthy, and especially during these Army McCarthy hearings. So toward the end, there was still support, but nothing like it had been before. But yeah, the press in the state was divided on him.
It's too bad to lose your job over your headlines, huh?
It is.
Yeah.
Play a big part.
Yeah. Thank you, Ruth, very much for your call.
You're welcome.
Joan in Menominee. Hi, Joan.
Oh, good morning. My father was a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, in the early 50s, and he was under investigation, as many university people, many professors were at that time. The charges were that he had belonged as a student at Cal in Berkeley, that he had been a member of various organizations which were called Communist Front organizations. And it was a very frightening time for so many involved in, you know, higher education. They were really under attack, and the charges were extensive. I do remember seeing a list of many, many, many organizations that long out of existence. But it was a scary time, and I think that also led to the loyalty oath movement on many university campuses, where the professors were required to sign a loyalty oath, loyal to the United States. And I just wondered if you have any comment about that.
Oh, I'm sure he does. Thank you for your call.
Absolutely. Many universities required professors as a condition of employment to sign these loyalty oaths. Well, those who refused to sign were fired. One thing that's sort of curious about McCarthy, and it goes to his shrewdness, frequently he talked about communist infiltration of universities and colleges, and he would talk about Harvard and especially places in the Northeast, but never did he criticize the University of Wisconsin. He knew, in some ways, he knew that these were his constituents. And in terms of people on the left, there were probably as many people on the left in Madison as there were at Harvard or at Berkeley in the 1950s.
Oh, that's fascinating. Very interesting. Thanks, Joan, for the call. Jeanette from Milwaukee writes, as a Catholic high schooler, we were urged to attend McCarthy's appearance at the Southside Armory in Milwaukee. He was our hero, and I still have the program for that day and his autograph. Since then, I am embarrassed that, though young, I was a believer. How much influence did the Catholic Church have in supporting him?
It had a lot of influence, and I grew up in part of the time in Appleton, which was just 8 miles away from McCarthy's hometown of Grand Chute, and it was in the 1950s. Yes, he was the local hero among Catholics, and one of the reasons that the elder Kennedy supported him so much was because he was Catholic, and it was just kind of this feeling that Catholics had to stick together, because at the time there was still a very strong anti-Catholic prejudice, and would certainly influence Kennedy's election in 1960. So it's a kind of a complicated thing. Not everybody who supported McCarthy did so solely because of the communist issue.
Mm-hmm. He died very young, didn't he?
At 48, and cirrhosis, hepatitis, but probably cirrhosis of the liver. And after his censure in 1954 by the Senate, he was defeated. I mean, he went downhill very quickly. He had always been a heavy drinker, but he drank even more and drank himself to death, likely.
Mm. Well, this has been a fascinating hour. You were great, and some very interesting calls this hour, too. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Our guest this hour, Patrick Maney, he's a history professor, and he teaches at Boston College. He's written a couple books, biographies, one of Franklin Roosevelt and also another on New Deal Senator Robert La Follette. So McCarthy, of course, would figure into that. And he's from Wisconsin, to boot. Can't get a better guest than that, Rhonda Fanning. Thanks very much to Rhonda for producing this show. And thanks to Rhonda for on-air production as well. To Kill a Mockingbird coming up. Stay with us.